Bomb.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. It feels like we've already seen Shadow Government the movie. Underground bunkers in secret locales, very important people secretly doing very important things in the name of national security, terrorists taking aim at the seat of American government. But now comes news of Shadow Government the reality. Well, we know the cast, sort of. 100 or so top-level federal employees whisked away for what their families know only to be an extended business trip. We know their mandate, sort of, to be America's second-string players just in case the first string gets wiped out in a catastrophic attack on the Capitol. And we know the setting, sort of. Fortified bunkers dug deep in the ground along the eastern seaboard where neither missile nor media can hurt the people inside. But it is the unknowns that are the most compelling and potentially the most troubling. Like why America's shadow government has only one branch, the executive, and why it will likely remain open for business indefinitely. And what the White House knows about threats to national security that it isn't telling. Connection listeners, do you feel more or less assured by news of a just-in-case government waiting in the wings? And what do you want to know about the shadow government? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined first on the line by Barton Gellman, reporter for The Washington Post. Bart Gellman, your story about the shadow government hit the newsstands last Friday. Did you have any idea that at the time you'd be telling Tom Daschle and other congressmen about it in that story?
No, frankly, I didn't. I've known that there were contingency plans for this kind of thing for a long time, and there are 8 members of Congress, including, of course, the Senate leader, who normally get notified of important secrets like this, so I thought he would know.
And in your research, did you find out what the people are doing wherever they are?
Well, I have only a fairly vague idea of that. There's preparing for the actual transition. It's one thing to drill on this or to say you've got this hideout squirreled away somewhere. It's another thing when you arrive and find that the computers don't work quite as you think they ought to, and there aren't enough phone lines, and it turns out you don't have secure video links to other branches of government that you thought you had. And so I think a lot of what they're doing is fixing up the place, and I assume that if they get that far, then they're going to try to do as much as possible of their normal jobs as telecommuters.
And these are the people who would be looking after basic services in the event of an attack. We're talking about food and water and transportation, telecommunications, those sorts of things. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, our society is run by all these enormously complex links and networks. And just supposing there were some sort of awful attack on the nation's capital, you could imagine all kinds of cascading effects. People would be running around, there would be the regulatory authorities that normally pay attention to whether, you know, the electrical grid is functioning during contingencies might not be there to pay attention to that. And so you have people who at a working level understand how the federal government wraps its arms around these subjects who are there in an invulnerable place ready to do that job if they need to.
And how would they ever say, time to go home?
It's a great question that I have been puzzling over myself. I don't know how you can ever prove the negative. Once you've assessed that there is some risk, however small, that Al-Qaeda has a portable nuclear weapon and that it could strike without warning, I don't see how you ever talk yourself into believing that you don't need to keep this shadow capability running forever. One official said to me that this may just be part of the new reality.
Bart, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Barton Gellman is a reporter for The Washington Post, and I'll introduce 2 other guests now. Paul Light is vice president and director of the Government Studies Program at the Brookings Institution in Washington. He's joining us from a studio there. And Matthew Bunn is assistant director of the Science, Technology, and Public Policy Program at the Belfer Center at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, and we're going to call him a nuclear expert at Harvard from now on, because I can't say that again and again and again. Welcome to both of you.
Good to be here.
Nice to be here.
Paul, you're supposed to know about this stuff. What are those people doing down there?
I haven't got a clue. I just haven't got a clue. I don't know who you'd send to these secret bunkers, and I don't know what you'd have them doing. I'm both puzzled and frightened by it all, really. It's rather like a Noah's Ark of bureaucrats. I mean, which ones would you send? The people who administer the Social Security Administration? The people who run the dairy price support systems? Would you send General Services Administration people? The big housekeeping agency? I mean, it's got to be the greatest game in town right now to figure out who actually got the call, and a lot of people saying to themselves, why didn't I get the call? That would be sort of typical Washington speculation.
Well, I'm going to come back a little later on in the program to the puzzling, frightening aspects of it, but I should bring Matthew in on the frightening aspect, because the last time he was in the studio with me, he was telling about all the different and easy ways that people could find to move loose nukes into the United States from wherever, Russia or as I say, wherever. When you look at the reason, the stated reason, Matthew, why this shadow government is in place, it's specifically because of the threats that you talk about, that these sorts of loose nukes are pretty easy to move around.
Unfortunately, that's true. A crude nuclear explosive could be put in any one of the 100 million trucks that cross our borders every year. It could be put in a standard cargo container that gets loaded off of a freight ship in one of our ports. Could be loaded onto one of the many, many aircraft that cross our borders every year. There's a lot of unregulated little, you know, Cessna and Gulfstream type aircraft that are coming across our borders. There's a lot of ways to get a nuclear weapon into this country. And unfortunately, while the material you make a nuclear weapon out of is radioactive, it's not that radioactive, and it's very hard to detect it unless you know exactly where to look. If you've got a tip that says it's on this boat or it's in this block of a city, yeah, you got a pretty good chance of finding it. But if all you know is, you know, it's somewhere in New York State, forget it.
See, we, along with news of the shadow government, got news of a credible threat that Washington was assessing in the fall that, now you can correct me here if I'm wrong, Matthew, that a 10-kiloton nuclear warhead had gone missing in Russia, and Al-Qaeda might have it, and maybe it's in the United States, and that was one of the reasons why everybody went underground and started turning on the consoles and the computers. In light of that, do you think it was a smart thing to do?
Well, I think it probably makes some sense to have at least some limited capability, but I very much doubt that it would be a very effective capability if the event actually arose. As Paul was saying, there's so many aspects of the federal government. There's no way that you could replicate all of the things that are, in fact, important to keeping our society functioning with just 100 or so people underground somewhere. I would question how credible the threat in October was. The reason they didn't inform anybody in New York of the fact that they had this threat that a bomb might be set off in New York is because they judged that it was a pretty low probability that this report was actually true. It came only from one source. The source was not judged to be a particularly reliable one. We have, at least on the actual assembled nuclear weapons, we have reasonably good reason to believe that the Russians have an accounting of where each one of those weapons is. Not true of the nuclear material, but true of the weapons. So I give that particular threat that occurred in October a relatively low credibility ranking. They did ultimately decide that it was not correct. And there was a time, though, when people were seriously concerned.
Paul Light, did it ever cross your mind, or do you think it's possible that this leak of the shadow government operating underground somewhere near Washington was meant to be leaked, that the administration actually wanted this news out there?
I never question the possibility that a leak is deliberate. This administration complains constantly about the leaking around town, but is often the place where the leaks begin. Washington is a very leaky city, and the vast majority of leaks are deliberate. So I don't know why they would pick this particular moment.
I'm just wondering, in context of what I'm discussing with Matthew, the nuclear risk, whether or not they judged it worthwhile to say, well, don't worry, we've got the backup gang in place.
It's troubling to me if, in fact, it was leaked like this. This is a city, I'm a Washingtonian, that is desperately trying to recover from September 11th. Our tourism industry has been battered. We're about to see the cherry blossoms bloom. And the notion that we have a shadow government, that there's some urgency about having a shadow government, ain't going to do much for the tourism season that's coming up. And I think that if it was leaked deliberately, it sure would be nice to know why. We have a right, I suspect, as citizens to be informed at some level if there's a credible threat. And that's the troubling side of this.
We're going to Framingham, Massachusetts. Ruth is joining us. Hello, Ruth.
Good morning. This is very frivolous, but I think we need a little frivolity. My husband worked for the Department of Justice Tax Division in the Eisenhower government back in 1955, and he carried in his wallet this little card. He was to mail in, and someone would get back to him and tell him where to go. And we used to giggle about it because he said that the only good that he could do was that he knew CPR, and maybe that would help. And I guess this is where everybody's going now.
But come on, Ruth. We had to protect the tax collectors. How would you ever have a government without tax collectors?
Well, it was just a fun thing. And for years, I think he didn't throw that card away until maybe the 80s. It was just sort of a fun thing that he carried. But here we go again. Thank you very much. And I thoroughly enjoy you being with us.
All right, Ruth. Thanks very much for your call.
Thank you.
Paul, go ahead.
Well, there is a very playful side to this. I mean, how do you tell your boss that you're taking 90 days of vacation, or you've got a doctor's appointment that's going to last 90 days? You don't want anybody to know that you've been called out to this bunker.
Yeah, you won't be coaching the soccer team this season.
And yeah, what are you going to be doing out there? I mean, it's rather like being vice president. It's a job that has absolutely no utility until a disaster strikes. I mean, what do you spend your days doing? I think we learned from the Washington Post that the early days of the shadow government were spent figuring out how to connect wires to systems, and that would speak to a certain type of person being out there. I love federal employees. I'm very supportive of the public service. The notion of having 100 GS-14 and 15s, which is the higher grades of the civil service, in a bunker for 90 days kind of inspires you to wonder what in God's name would they be doing.
Preservation of the gene pool, isn't it?
I suppose so. And there's an important side to this. There is an important function for a shadow government, but we need to remember that the vast, vast majority of federal employees do not work in Washington, D.C. They work in the field offices and the regional offices. The federal government would go on with or without Washington, D.C.
All right, Connection listeners, our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. On the serious side of the Bush government's decision to put the shadow government up and running, what is the government saying to us as residents of this country about the nature of the threat? And should there be more if, in fact, they believe the shadow government is a necessary part of the continuation of the business of the country? My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon, and this hour we're talking about the shadow government, which is up and running in Washington, D.C. With me on the program, Paul Light is director of the Government Studies Program at the Brookings Institution, and Matthew Bunn is nuclear expert from Harvard. We're going to bring Stephen Dykus into the conversation right now. He's a professor of national security and environmental law at Vermont Law School and author of a textbook of case studies about continuity of government scenarios, and that's specifically what we're talking about, COG, as they call it in Washington, continuity of government. Stephen, you've been studying this for, I don't know, more than 10 years. What can you tell us about the wisdom of the decision that we're looking at in Washington now?
Well, we should all be happy that there are some plans in place to deal with a great crisis that might be caused by a terrorist attack. We should be concerned, however, that those plans are not well known, and in particular that they've not been communicated to the Congress, or indeed that Congress hadn't played a role in their formulation.
So in terms of not being well known, you're not talking about what we might know from reading the Washington Post. You're talking about how well coordinated the executive, the judiciary, and Congress is in terms of preserving those three legs of the government stool.
Yes, I think the president and Congress independently have created a dangerous situation. In a great crisis, the last thing that we want is added confusion about who's in charge and pursuant to what authority they would act. The resulting chaos and confusion, I think, would make recovery from the crisis much more difficult. So the public needs to be better informed about these plans, and Congress and the president need to coordinate their activities better.
What is the big problem with just having the executive branch backed up underground? What do you see as the big problem with that?
Under our constitutional system, our government has three branches, each with a unique and albeit overlapping role with the others. Congress, in this case, ought to long ago have taken the initiative to adopt guidelines for great emergencies like this. That is, to outline the organization of standby agencies or standby executive government like the one that's currently in place. It should have described trigger mechanisms for the activation of these shadow governments and specified how we revert to a normal routine, if that can ever happen again. It also needs to have described some liaison with the other branches of government, and it should have laid out a process for reporting and for oversight for itself. We've got a perfect model for this in amendments to the National Security Act of 1947 that were adopted in the wake of the Iran-Contra affair.
But Paul Light, I suppose that because these things that Stephen's talking about have not been followed is one of the reasons why many people's first reaction to the shadow government is one of cynicism.
In what way? I mean,
if the organizational charts are there and they're not being followed, if the depth of the thinking behind the decision to fire up the consoles doesn't follow the models of communication and organization that Stephen's describing, then what's the real motivation?
Well, I'm this is part of the troubling aspect of all of this, which is that we've had some problems over the first year of the Bush administration in communicating between the branches. This administration early on concluded that Congress could not be trusted with sensitive information. It didn't matter whether it was Republicans or Democrats. Congress just can't be trusted. Now we find out that Congress can't be trusted with even the most sensitive of information, which is that we have a shadow government. And that speaks to a persistent problem between these two branches in terms of governing either pre- or post-Washington apocalypse. And it is a troubling conclusion. I'm not cynical about it. I just believe that if the Bush administration had been forthright about this, there'd be a lot less nervousness in this town, and people would be saying, yes, this was important to do. We need to think through and be responsible about it. Now we find out about it. We still don't know very much about who's in the shadow government and what they're doing. I think that the Bush administration is going to have to eventually give us a lot of information to clear the air here.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255, and we're going to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sam is joining us. Hi, Sam.
Hi.
am I on?
Yes, you are.
Thanks for letting me through. There was, along with the general nervousness and cynicism, if I may just throw in another thing, there was recently an article in the Times, I believe, describing that some documents they found in Qaeda caves indicated that their knowledge of nuclear weaponry and all such stuff was amateurish at best. In fact, they might have been ripped off by some international crooks who were going to take advantage of their looking for such stuff. And the sense of it was that the sense of a threat from that direction is minimal. So I guess I'm just supporting everybody. Given that, wouldn't it be much better to take some time and if that's a credible threat, have it in the open? The reason, another reason for making people like me nervous is the whole thing about Cheney being in a bunker and yet stonewalling the General Accounting Office on stuff. You know, this whole sense of this government being in a bunker mentality, even on stuff that we the citizens want to see. And this on top of it all is certainly not comforting.
Matthew Bunn, maybe you can pick up on the first part, what we know about what Al-Qaeda may know about nuclear weapons.
Well, what we have found so far in Afghanistan is, I would say, somewhat reassuring. The documents that have been found indicate a very sophisticated and expansive program on conventional weapons, every conceivable kind of bomb and explosive and booby trap and so on, but a much, much more limited effort on weapons of mass destruction and particularly on nuclear. We found no nuclear material. No evidence of nuclear material having been machined or acquired or what have you. The nuclear weapons documents do exist. Some of them have some useful information in them, but they're not incredibly sophisticated. Now, on the other hand, the absence of evidence that Al-Qaeda has made progress toward nuclear weapons isn't the same as evidence of absence. We don't know what it is that they took away with them when they ran rather than leaving it behind in the sites that we've been able to search. And given the insecurity of nuclear material in a variety of countries around the world, given that we now know that this very senior Pakistani nuclear weapon scientist did in fact meet with Osama bin Laden and was grilled by Osama bin Laden about nuclear weapons design, I think it's reasonable to have some concern about the possibility that they may be making more progress than we know of.
And whatever evidence might exist in an abandoned house or a cave in Afghanistan might not be the only evidence worth paying attention to, because we know that a number of Al-Qaeda people have moved to other countries some years back in terms of preparing for whatever it is they were doing.
Indeed, and you don't leave your best stuff behind when you run. I think the key point here is that terrorists can't make nuclear bombs if they haven't got the nuclear material. So the first thing that we have to do on an urgent basis is establish a flexible, fast-paced program to beef up the security for all the nuclear weapons and all the nuclear material in the world, wherever it may be. We're doing that already cooperatively with Russia. Within Russia, we have to do it faster in Russia, but there's a lot of other countries in the world where this kind of weapons-usable material exists, and we need to move as fast as we can to get that material secured. If we do that, we have an excellent chance of preventing nuclear weapons terrorism from ever occurring.
Okay, Sam, thanks for your call. We're going to Weston, Massachusetts, and Armine is joining us. Hi, Armine.
Hello there. My question is, if our government leaders felt they were in such danger, why didn't they warn us? In the past, when there have been dangers to our country, we have been warned to prepare shelters, to set aside food. Our children have been taught how to evacuate their classrooms. Nothing like that was even hinted at for us.
It's an interesting question, Armine, because it was exactly the same thing that went through my mind the first time I read this in the newspaper. I was going, well, they're all underground. What kind of plans should I be making?
Exactly.
Paul Light.
Well, this is a geographic specific threat, as I understand it. The notion is to take senior executives out of Washington and put them in fortified bunkers so that if Washington were somehow devastated, the federal government could be restarted with basically the flick of a switch. For Washingtonians like myself, we're asking that question exactly now. I mean, is there something going on here that we need to know? But I think it is geographic specific, which raises the point that the vast majority of feds are not in Washington, D.C., and that you could easily create a chain of command in the wake of some catastrophe here that would involve very senior officials who are career and political outside of Washington, D.C., and the regional offices, 10 regional offices around the country, including Atlanta, Boston, New York, Chicago, Denver, and so forth.
And Stephen Dykus, wouldn't that make more sense if, in fact, the threat was aimed specifically at Washington in your studies of continuity of government?
Yes, it could. There's another dimension, however, to the caller's question, that is concerning public information. The public urgently needs to know that some kind of viable plan exists to deal with a great emergency like this, whether it happens in Washington or Chicago or San Francisco. The public also has to know that if the worst happens, that somebody will be in charge. Now, we've made a bargain with ourselves that we can't know everything about this representative government, but we at least need to know the outlines of the plans in order to judge that they're both legitimate and credible. In addition, terrorists need to know that we have a viable plan of recovery so that they'll be less tempted to mount an attack than they would otherwise.
Stephen, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Stephen Dykus is a professor of national security and environmental law at Vermont Law School. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And to Chelmsford, Massachusetts, Bruce is with us. Hi, Bruce.
Oh, hi. I just got a question for your folks who seem to have a lot of background in this continuity of government plan and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And that is to the effect that isn't the underlying assumption of when this continuity of government group sort of takes charge, wouldn't this be under martial law?
You mean only put in place under martial law?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Paul?
I suspect that if there were that kind of catastrophe in Washington, we'd have a period of time where we would be under martial law. I'm not 100% sure of it. I think what's important to note here is that most of the people in the shadow government are career executives. They're not political. What we're looking here for is the interface between the political leadership of government, which would include both the executive and legislative as well as judicial branches, but executive and legislative primarily, and the sort of career apparatus, which does not exist in Washington, D.C., for the most part, but outside of the Capitol. I don't know how long a period of martial law would last, and I'm not sure that martial law would be imposed on all areas of the country. In the event that our government were destroyed through a catastrophe here in Washington, D.C., I think all bets are off in terms of how we'd react, and it's prudent to have some conversations about how you would operate the succession. Whether you want to do that kind of conversation in secret without engaging the Congress or informing the public, I think, is an entirely different question.
I know this is very hypothetical, Matthew, but how much time would Washington have to take, you know, those sorts of decisions, martial law, no martial law? I mean, I guess it comes down to the different way that...
Potentially none at all. It's quite possible that such a thing could be brought in and set off with absolutely no warning whatsoever. In the 1950s and the late 40s, there was this same concern when the Soviet Union was getting nuclear weapons but didn't yet have bombers or missiles that could reach us. People worried about, well, what if they send a bomb in a ship into one of our harbors? And Oppenheimer was asked to chair a study. Well, how would we detect such a thing? And it became known as the screwdriver study because he said, you know, really the only way is to open the case with a screwdriver and see what's inside. We have a little bit better technology now for detecting that kind of thing. But the fact is these materials are not that radioactive. It's hard to find something unless you have good intelligence that tells you where to look.
So whether you have a neutron flux detector attached to your belt as a customs agent is not going to provide you with any degree of certainty that an area would be safe.
Well, if you are sitting right there with the bag that has the nuclear weapon in it, that's another story. There are options for putting in good detectors. There are detectors installed in the Moscow airport today that search the bags going out of the Moscow airport. Those were put in with U.S. Assistance. But if you get a warning that says somewhere in the western half of the United States there's a nuclear weapon, you're in trouble because you don't have enough information to go looking for it and with that kind of information.
Bruce, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Your own thoughts about martial law and the way that the government would switch over into some kind of emergency move. Would you sooner see a move to martial law rather than this kind of indefinite continuation of an underground bunker?
That's a difficult question. I think that would be probably the only thing that would allow us to maintain order, at least in regions of the country. On the other hand, if we ever actually had martial law imposed at the national level in this country, the thought just scares me about as much as a nuclear attack does, because I'm a freedom loving person and I greatly fear that if martial law were ever imposed, the fellows who would be in charge would never feel safe to relinquish it.
Quick question, Bruce, do you think you're getting the straight goods from Washington on this one?
Absolutely not.
And that's a quick answer. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for taking my call.
All right.
Okay. Thanks for your guests, too.
All right. Connection listeners, we're talking about continuity of government. We're talking about the shadow government, which is up and running in a bunker not far from Washington, D.C. In fact, a number of the locations have been posted on various internet websites, and there is a debate underway in the media about whether or not the Washington Post should have written the story that it wrote and whether or not the New York paper earlier this week should have published a photograph of the bunker door because the terrorists might be able to get a look at that. And, after all, these places are supposed to be secure. Does any of that matter? Your thoughts about the notions that are going on behind the scenes in the way that Washington thinks that it can keep things going with the shadow government. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. We're talking about the shadow government, which has several dozen senior-level bureaucrats working, as we speak, underground in case there's any kind of catastrophic event above ground and the business of running this country needs to be maintained from somewhere else. And if we think back to the 1950s when concrete bunkers were first being poured underground, certainly through a list of presidents since that time. I know in the Reagan administration and Matthew Bunn, when you were in the White House under the Clinton administration, the updating of this way of protecting the business of government was being considered, right?
Absolutely. President Clinton issued a major new decision directive about these kinds of continuity of government issues. At that time, it was still, in a sense, a remnant of Cold War concerns. I mean, the issue was, what if some country takes out Washington with a missile?
At that point, what if Ukraine loses control of its weapons and some warlord, but, one of the gangsters gets control and...
Exactly. Now the issue is much more a terrorist concern, although the issue of a missile being fired from some hostile state never completely goes away. The issue is mainly a terrorist issue, and that makes a somewhat different situation. If you have a missile, you at least have a half an hour or so of warning. If you have a boat with a bomb in the Potomac, you might have no warning at all.
And Paul, your view on the appropriate way to prepare for the type of threat that Matthew's talking about, because at one end of the spectrum, you could say the smart and the brave thing to do would be to sit in your office above ground, work really hard at controlling whatever it is that you can, but not say to the public, we're so uncertain about our ability to do that that we're going to have a second level of government underground.
Well, there are two points to be made here. The first is that we do have a succession plan for transferring power from the president to the vice president under the Constitution, and then under federal statute, should the president and vice president both be incapacitated or killed, we move down a succession chain that does involve members of Congress, which raises the question, why weren't these members of Congress who could eventually be pulling the switch to restart government introduced to the concept that there was the shadow government in place? Given the type of threat that we're talking about, the notion of putting all these individuals in a bunkered facility may make less sense than it appears. If we're talking about one nuclear weapon sneaking in across the border and being targeted at Washington, D.C., these 100 or so federal employees might be just as safe at a Motel 6 or a conference center out in western Pennsylvania. I rather suspect the terrorists would not target them, but that they would target Washington, D.C. You know, it makes good sense to go ahead and do some planning here, but I think prevention is the hope and goal here. And if these individuals in the 100 in the shadow government are so essential, I sure hope that they're continuing to do their work somehow from long distance.
1-800-423-8255. That's our number, and we're going to Attleboro, Massachusetts. Steve's joining us. Hello, Steve.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
I'm delighted. Actually, I love the idea of a shadow government set up. If I really thought that 100 people could do the job, I can see laying off a couple of 100,000 others, sending them home, and we've simplified things greatly. just facetious. No, actually, I think our government's just being responsible. They're doing the responsible thing. They're doing the due diligence thing. If they weren't taking these precautions and something happened, everybody would say, oh, my goodness, why weren't you guys on the ball? Why weren't you prepared for this? I don't understand why people are whining and complaining about a government taking precautions.
Do you think the shadow government should remain in place in perpetuity then?
Certainly in place as it is now in the situation we're in at the moment. If someone was to declare all calm and all peaceful, And had some confident assurance of that, sure, maybe people go back to their normal lives. My understanding is that this is not just 100 select people, but rather they're serving apparently 2 or 3 month tours of duty, as the way it was explained, where they're actually separated from their families don't even know where they're going, and they'll be rotated out with other individuals taking their place. Which means it's not necessarily the 100 individuals that are important, right, but rather the tasks they're doing that are important.
Matthew Bunn, can you talk to Steve about whether or not, if this is the threat, that is, if the current threat is enough to have these people underground, whether or not we'll ever be in a situation where there isn't a threat that's as serious as it is today? Does that make any sense?
Well, I think there's some hope. If we got ourselves into a situation where we had managed to create a world in which we knew for a fact that every nuclear weapon was secure, every kilogram of plutonium and highly enriched uranium, the essential ingredients of nuclear weapons, were secure, that we would be able to relax significantly, because under that circumstance, if the terrorists can't get hold of the material for a bomb, they can't make a bomb. But we're a long, long way from that world right now, and I think we need to substantially beef up our activities to get there. And even if you got there, the question is, well, how many horses left the barn before you put those security measures in place?
Yeah, it only takes one, right?
The CIA recently released quite a good report on the security for nuclear weapons and materials in Russia, and they said, we assess that some undetected smuggling has already occurred. We don't know how much. So that is troubling. My guess is they're right. My guess is it would be quite surprising if we knew every single one of the thefts that had occurred and every single one of them had been intercepted. Nonetheless, I think we can drastically reduce the probability of this kind of threat through actions that we know how to take that are basically a matter of putting the political muscle and the money behind getting the job done.
All right. Steve, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255 to Salem, Massachusetts now. Sean is joining us. Hello, Sean.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious what safeguards there are in place for this administration to be putting new things into effect here. I mean, they put the shadow government into effect without the knowledge of Congress. And what else? Is there concern in Washington for what this government is doing? I'm by no means a conspiracy theorist, but is there any concern what they're doing under the guise of protecting our homeland?
You mean just a basic checks and balances, who's watching
who? Yes, absolutely. I was under the impression the shadow government was only the executive branch. Is that correct?
Yes, as we understand it.
Mm, and who's watching them or not watching? Well, yeah, watching them.
Yeah, fair enough. Paul Light.
Well, I don't think anybody who's been observing this story is saying that it's a bad idea to think about contingencies like this. We're in a troublesome age where these kinds of plans have to be considered. I think the puzzling aspect of all of this, and in fact the troubling aspect, is that, again, we have a situation where the public is the last to know, members of Congress are the last to know. And I don't think that in this sort of post-Enron, post-campaign finance, this period of time where Americans are hungry for information, that this is well handled if it leaks out or is somehow found out by an enterprising set of reporters, and suddenly Americans discover that, in fact, the administration has been thinking these thoughts. Are they trying to protect us? Are they trying to protect us from our own worst fears? What's going on here? I would disagree with the earlier caller who says that this is basically a matter of whining. I think Americans are concerned at this point that we are in a struggle between the basic core values, the rule of law, the liberties that this country stands for, and the need to legitimately protect this country from very devious and cruel threats. And it is a tension that we experience all the time here in policymaking. And once again, we have a situation where the administration, sadly, has chosen to not tell Congress and not tell the city that, in fact, it's doing the wise and due diligent thing.
So in your view, it is the administration that has politicized this issue through its own clumsiness?
I wouldn't say politicized. I just think that this administration, for whatever reason, doesn't like to be public about what's going on. And it's been from the very beginning of the administration. And sometimes it's best to be public. It's best to sit down with the American public in that cardigan sweater or around the fireside and just have a good, difficult but honest chat with us about what's going on. And this administration really hasn't been forthcoming in asking us to kind of join in the conversation about what needs to be done here in this new era. It's been much more, we'll tell you when you need to know, a paternalistic kind of view. And I think that's unwise politically, and I also think it's unwise at this particular moment in history.
Sean, thank you for your call. We're going to Boston, Massachusetts, and Al will join us. Al, just before you do, I'll remind our listeners, you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. And now you're on the program, Al.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if you might want to have the your guest address the issue of the popular culture involved in this idea of the shadow government underground. I'm the generation that learned the order of succession from Dr. Strangelove and Mr. Kubrick.
Right.
And this whole idea of going into the ground to protect ourselves from the rest of the world. There's a whole fiction, body of fiction work that's grown up in the past 50 years about people living in bunkers for generations.
I think the part that that struck me most in answer to your question, Al, was something that Paul Light was saying earlier about these guys would be safer at a Motel 6 somewhere in Pennsylvania because, Matthew, you were nodding your head when Paul was saying that.
Indeed. I mean, one of the things that people don't realize is, you know, a nuclear weapon would be very devastating, be one small part of the country. And if someone is at a Motel 6 in Pennsylvania, you know, no one in their right mind who had a nuclear weapon is going to waste it on some random Motel 6 in Pennsylvania. I mean, the only reason you don't just use a Motel 6 in Pennsylvania is because you need a lot of communications equipment and so on. And in the old days, these bunkers were built for a threat where we envisioned that there'd be a lot of nuclear weapons.
But the envisioning, as Al points out, comes from our popular culture understanding of bunkers and consoles and computer screens, really, rather than why it's needed or what's necessary, right?
Yeah.
Well, the notion of putting this shadow government in a bunker conjures up the specter of the bunker being attacked. That's why you would put them in a fortified bunker. And that's what gets conspiracy theorists going. They say, well, do we think there's more than one nuclear weapon, or do we think the North Koreans might be ready to go to war? What's happening in China? Or do the Pakistanis and the Indians have nuclear technology that they might be launching shortly? I mean, it gets people going because you create the image here of a shadow government that has to be underground to be protected in case the rest of government is destroyed. It's fodder for a kind of conversation that occurs with or without the president's participation that gets Americans very nervous and Washingtonians in particular highly agitated.
But as residents, we also acknowledge government's right to keep certain things secret, though, right?
Well, yes, but, I mean, we have a culture of secrecy in Washington that is beyond belief. We classify material that is trivial at best. I think this is one secret that couldn't be kept for long. I don't know how the Washington Post found out. I suspect that either the White House leaked it or that, you know, basically some of the federal employees who were heading out for their 90-day tours perhaps were not as careful as they might be, or that this is just a hard secret to keep.
They were going hunting and they forgot to take their boots, right?
You know, you've got the mother of all job excuses here. And at some point, these folks come back from their 90-day tour and they say, well, where have you been? And eventually, maybe it gets out. I don't know. It's a hard secret to keep.
One of the interesting things, actually, is that both the Cleveland Plain Dealer and U.S. News and World Report had this story back in October of last year, admittedly in much shorter versions, and you know, it fell like a stone in a puddle, and nobody paid any attention. Then when it's on the front page of the Washington Post, we're all paying attention.
Thanks to both of you for being with me.
Thank you.
Matthew Bunn is a nuclear weapons management and security expert at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard. Paul Light heads the Government Studies Department at the Brookings Institution. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Jill Teitelman is our intern. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Life is gonna be a wow, wow, wee.